We're going to begin a new series of study this morning. You know, everyone likes a good mystery. I suspect most of us, if we don't read books that are mysteries, we watch television shows or movies or do and enjoy other things that have an element of mystery in them. Seem like the two great lasting kinds of television shows are those that involve mystery in some way and those that involve comedy. And I think all of us enjoy those, whether we enjoy the particular shows or not. I think about some of the popular television shows right now, the CSI series, the CSI in Las Vegas, the original, then the one in Miami, then the one in New York. I'm still waiting for the one for Lubbock. You know, they keep spinning off new and new ones like that. But every one of them, and all sorts of other shows as well, whether it's detective shows, police shows, or even get away from the those that are fictional at their base, that are specifically mysteries, even the long-running series Law and Order on television, they always involve something has happened, probably to someone. There's clues, there's evidence, there's suspects, but don't know quite who did what. Or even why. And so the show revolves around solving that mystery. The books that sell millions of copies on the bookshelves, bestsellers in the fiction category, are almost always in the category of mystery. Now some of them may mix in with it other things like romance or history, but there's always that element of mystery, of trying to solve some problem, solve some unknown and make it known. To tie together all the pieces and make sense out of it. Someone has said that the Old Testament, part of our Bible, is the greatest mystery book ever written. Now, we don't often think of it in terms of that, but that's because we've already seen the end, or at least most of the end. We've already seen that show. We already know how it turned out. But if we think for a while about those people who lived in the Old Testament time, who were participants and observers of what's going on through the Old Testament. It spread across 1,500 years, rise and fall of kingdoms, coming and going of kings, prophets, wars, nations. And yet, while that was history, there was always in the minds of those people, something more is coming. Something more is ahead. And they kept trying to figure it out. They kept trying to understand it. Clues were given. Circumstantial evidence was provided. Events occurred. And yet they couldn't quite make it all fit together and understand what was to happen. How can we benefit from that? And we may say, well, we already know how it turned out. We know that the Old Testament was pointing to the new. We know that the prophets were talking about Christ. We know that the law was preparing the people for the gospel. And we know that even as God said, these people are my special people, talking about the Jews, even that was a preparation for the time when God would say, all people everywhere who shared in the spiritual characteristics of Abraham are my people. But how can we benefit from all that? First of all, in some parts it'll be a review and a refresher. But I think much more than that, we will probably see things we never saw before, hear things we never heard before, think about things we never thought about before. I went to Bible college after I finished, I didn't finish regular college, but I left regular college to go to Bible college and, after I left that Bible college, one of the things I came away with was I owned a great deal more religious books than I did when I went there. You know, that's part of the requirement to take classes at a Bible college is to buy all these books that are used in all of these courses. And because of the pressure of both making a living for my family as well as taking classes and preaching some on the weekends and so forth, I only read just enough to pass my courses. But after I got out of school and was working in the ministry, I had this library already started of books. And one of the books that I'd purchased while I was at Bible college was a book called The Scheme of Redemption. And truthfully, I think that when I bought it for the course I took it in, we ended up not having to read a single page in the book, even though it was required for the course. But after I was out of college, 2 or 3, 4 or 5 years, I started reading that book. To me, it was one of the most eye-opening books I've ever read in my life. Even though I'd grown up in a Christian family, my parents became Christians when I was 5 years old, and though I had become a Christian while still young and at home, and now gone through Bible college and was now out preaching, you'd think, surely by now it would have dawned on me the great scheme that God had that appears through the Bible from its beginning to its end. And yet suddenly in this book I saw the mystery revealed in a depth and a breadth I'd never seen or heard of before. And I'm sure many of those who taught me already knew that, but they didn't realize I didn't know it. Or they didn't know how to communicate it to me in a way I could hear it and understand it until then. And that's the way it will be for us, I think. And in doing that, our faith will grow in seeing how God worked in so many ways to bring about His purposes. And because our faith in God's working will grow, then our confidence in Him still being at work will also grow. And to know that even at the end of all things, it's all according to God's work taking place. And so we're going to begin this new series. I'm going to call it The Shadow of Good Things to Come. Don read for us there out of Hebrews chapter 1. And I think it sets the tone for us, and so we'll read it again. Hebrews 1, 1 through 3. It says, in the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various or many ways. But in these last days, He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He appointed the heir of all things and through whom He made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of His being, sustaining all things by His powerful word. And after He had provided purification for sins, He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty in heaven. And when we read that, you may think at first, you don't hear anything of mystery in that. You don't hear anything of how God was working in the Old Testament to bring about the things we then learn about in the New Testament. And yet, in fact, what we're hearing here is the introduction to a book called Hebrews, that the whole book is devoted to showing that's exactly what God was doing. And that doesn't mean we're going to primarily be studying Hebrews, but I'm just telling you, the book of Hebrews is one of those books in the Bible that tries to help us see, that tried to help the early Christians see, that God was working all through the Old Testament to bring about what they now knew and what we call the New Testament. And this, particularly in the book of Hebrews, it talks about how God worked through Moses and how God worked through the law that came by Moses, and that God worked through the practices, the ceremonies, the sacrifices, and the priesthood that God had instituted by Moses. And that all of those things were just pointing to, they were evidence, they were clues that when all tied together properly, pointed to Christ. And so later in the book of Hebrews, we hear these kind of things. In chapter 8 of Hebrews, for example, there it's talking about the priest that were a part of the Old Testament religious practice. And it says concerning them in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 5, they, that's the priest, they serve at a sanctuary. They served in the temple. They served at a sanctuary that is a copy and shadow of what is in heaven. So suddenly the writer tells us that Old Testament tabernacle and then later the temple were just a copy of something God had in heaven. Then he's going to go on to tell us that while those priests that served at the copy, Jesus serves at the real thing in heaven. And then again in chapter 10, he starts chapter 10 and verse 1 by saying the law, and he's talking about all those things that came from Moses, the Ten Commandments, the other laws, the ceremonies, the sacrifices, the feast, all of that, the tabernacle, all of that, the law is only a shadow of the good things that are coming and not the realities themselves. So here's, in a sense, is where he's letting us know plainly at last that his whole point is that whatever we're seeing in the Old Testament were just shadows of the good things that are coming. And so that's what we want to spend some time doing. I can't tell you how many lessons it will be or how long we will go. We'll go until either I or you are tired of it, and probably until I'm tired of it. That doesn't mean that we couldn't spend more time with it, but after a while something just sort of runs its course. But we want to look at these shadows of good things to come, as the Hebrew writer calls it. Now we hear that concept stated in other places in the New Testament in other ways. For example, Jesus himself in John chapter 5. John chapter 5, he has healed a man down in Jerusalem, and then he starts telling the people based on this miracle. He uses that as a sort of a prop. And I use that in the best possible sense. He uses that as a lever, an introduction to try to teach the people about who he is. If they could see him do the miracle, can't they make the connection with a little bit of help between his ability to do miracles and who he is? What that must say about who he is. And so he talks to them about there being life that he can bring people. And then he talks to them about the evidence of who he is, starting in 5:31. He talks about how that John testified about him, that the works he's doing testify about him, that the Old Testament testifies about him. And then when he gets to that part, when he's talking about how the Old Testament testifies about him, he says in verse 37, "And the Father who sent me has himself testified concerning me. Yet you have never heard his voice, nor seen his form, nor does his word dwell in you. For you do not believe the one he sent." He reminds them that they personally had never actually heard God speak. They had never seen God. Now that was a little different than could have been said about Moses in the Old Testament, for he both saw God's form and heard God speak personally. And it even wasn't exactly true concerning their ancestors, because their ancestors at Mount Sinai had heard God speak, even though they hadn't seen his form. But these people had neither seen God nor heard him personally, but they had his word. And they all acknowledged that this was God's words, and yet Jesus says of them, even though you have God's words, you're not letting God's words live in you. What does he mean by that? He says, because you do not believe the one he sent. If God's words he spoke back there really were alive for you, you would understand that they were talking about me, he said. And then in verse 39, you diligently study the scriptures because you think that by them you possess eternal life. These are the scriptures that testify about me. We might make the mistake and think that when he says that these are the scriptures that speak about me, that he was only talking about the prophecies. You know, the ones that talk about being born in Bethlehem, being a descendant of David, sitting on the throne of his father David forever. All of those, you know, prophecies. Born of a virgin. But he's talking about a lot more than just those scriptures. He's talking about all the scriptures. In verse 46, he says, if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But since you do not believe what he wrote, how are you going to believe what I say? It's very interesting, as I search the writings of Moses, I only find really one place Moses actually made a prophecy about the one who was to come. But what about all those other things he wrote? Jesus says Moses wrote about me. Was he just talking about that one prophecy of Moses? Or was there a lot more than that? A lot more. At the end of the Gospel of Luke, after his resurrection from the dead, as Jesus appears to his disciples and starting to show them that it's really him, that he really is alive from the dead, while he's going with the two on the road down to Emmaus, Luke 24, starting in verse 13, he finds these two disciples of his on the road down to Emmaus, and they're discussing the very things that had happened that day. They've gotten word that the tomb is empty. It's just been 3 days since Jesus was crucified on the cross, and all of their hopes and dreams, at least it seemed to them, have been crushed and shattered. And now suddenly comes word that the tomb is empty, and they're trying to make sense of it. Is someone taking the body? Some of their friends, other disciples, are saying they've met angels who say the angels told them he's risen from the dead. And so they're discussing that, and this stranger joins them. We don't understand how it would be possible that if they were such friends of Jesus, they wouldn't recognize him. But that was Jesus' choice, it seems, that they wouldn't. And so they have this discussion with this stranger who's joined them as they go along the road about what all has happened. And finally, Jesus has enough in verse 25 and said to them, "How foolish you are and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to him what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." Now here, of course, Jesus specifically is referring to the prophecy. But again, he's talking about the shadow of the good things to come. The shadow of the good things to come. We move to the other end of the New Testament in 1 Peter. This would be near the end of Peter's life, and so that would put it, you know, events that he's talking about or people he's writing to are living some 30 years in the future from the events that the gospel writers were recording. And yet as Peter's talking, he says in 1 Peter chapter 1 and in verse 10 beginning, "Concerning this salvation, the prophets who spoke of the grace that was to come to you searched intently and with the greatest care, trying to find out the time and circumstances to which the Spirit of Christ in them was pointing when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. But it was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves, but you, when they spoke of the things that have now been told you by those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven. Even angels long to look into these things." He says, as the prophets in the Old Testament spoke, they also desired intensely to understand what they were talking about, but they couldn't. They wanted to know if the things they were talking about applied to them or someone else. But Peter says, now it's clear that what they were speaking about was for us. What they had was a shadow. What we have is a reality. The shadow of good things to come. And so many other passages like that that we could look at. As I said, it's going to be more than just prophecy. In fact, we probably won't look quite so much at prophecy because that's mostly what we do look at when we talk about these things. So I feel like we're probably better schooled in the area of prophecy in the Old Testament and how it was fulfilled in the New. So we want to spend more time looking at some other clues, some other evidence, some other things that were a part of the Old Testament that were just a shadow of the good things to come. Among those, and I've made just a brief list, not exhaustive here on my piece of paper, first of all would be historical events. If you think for a moment, we already can think perhaps of some events in the Old Testament that are referred to in the New that in some way seem to be foreshadowing or pointing to something in the new. Ceremonies in the Old Testament. The offering of sacrifices, for example. And not just the offering of the sacrifice for sin. Here a couple of years ago, we read through that portion of the Old Testament in Leviticus and then again in Deuteronomy, where all the ceremonial practices were specified for the people of that time, where they made the wave offering and the thank offering and the burnt offering. Whenever someone was unclean, they had to go through certain ceremonies to become clean again, to be not clean physically, but to be ceremonially, or in effect, we would say spiritually clean. How many of those turn out to be pointing to something in the new that was going to happen? Certain themes and doctrines that keep running through the Old Testament that finally have their fulfillment in the new. The sacrificing of animals for sin. Certain promises about in the lineage of Abraham, and then that splits out from there in the lineage of one of his descendants, Jacob, and then in the lineage of Jacob, only one of his sons, Judah, and then in the lineage of Judah, only one of his descendants, David, would this person come. These great themes that run through the Old Testament, many of them. The celebration of certain holidays and memorials in the Old Testament that end up pointing to things in the new. And I know we really overlook that. We hear all the time about things like the Passover and Pentecost and the Feast of Tabernacles as we're reading various parts of the Scripture. The Day of Atonement, the Days of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of First Fruits. And yet we don't always make a connection with what that has to do with Christ in the New Testament. Well, there was in fact a connection. Paul, for example, says concerning Jesus that Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed for us. So what's the connection between Jesus being our Passover and that Passover the Jews first celebrated the night they were getting ready to leave Egypt over 1,500 years before? There's clearly a connection. Paul said there was. But there's many more than just that. I was just reading this morning in a book that I've had for quite some time on my shelf, but I had finally pulled it and was looking at it. And the author was pointing out that in the Gospel of John, let's see if I remember well what he read, what he said. In the Gospel of John, which has 879 verses in it, he says that in those 879 verses, of those, 660 of them are talking about events or things or words that Jesus said or did while he was either going to, at, or just leaving one of the great feasts of Israel. That's three-fourths of the entire book of John. I've always looked at the Gospel of John from the standpoint of it being a gospel of belief. And so it is. John says it was. And I tend to look at it from the standpoint of Jesus having great signs to show he was the one that was to come. And so it is. But this author suddenly helped me realize what I'd known ever since I first studied John, but just hadn't put it together, part of that great mystery we're talking about. And that is that John, the Gospel of John, focuses on the Jewish festivals, their feast, and ties the entire story of Jesus around those feasts. Why? Why? Because they also were pointing to the one to come. And he was that one. For example, we hear in the Gospel of John, on the last great day of the Feast of Tabernacles, when the people are celebrating how God had given them water in the wilderness. Certainly it wasn't them personally, but it had been their ancestors under Moses. When the people were thirsting for water and even grumbling because they didn't have it, and God had Moses strike the rock and water poured out of it, and God watered his people. On the last great day of that particular feast, Jesus stands up in the middle of that huge crowd gathered there for that celebration and says, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink." Now what did Jesus just do except connect himself to that Old Testament festival that celebrated God taking care of His people in the wilderness. That's what He just did. He said it pointed to Him. And there's so much more to be said. You'll hear some words that perhaps you've heard before, but we might not have ever particularly put definitions to them before. We'll hear about the word prophecy and prophets. We'll hear the words shadow and foreshadow. We know what a shadow is when we just think of it literally. A shadow is an image that's created by a reality. You know, as light shines upon some object, it casts a shadow. Now, the shadow seldom is exactly just like the reality. It may be distorted. It may be, not exactly accurate. You know, one of the things that when we were kids, we'd see the movies where suddenly you'd hear somebody big and bad coming and that have the dramatic music and you'd see the shadow cast up on the wall. You know, Disney was good about that. And it looked like it was a great monster coming. And finally, when they came around the corner, it was a little midget or something. You know, because the shadow wasn't just exactly like. It was a distorted image of the reality. The Scriptures talk over and over how things in the Old Testament were shadows of the new. And we tend to think of God speaking it in the past and then happening in the future. But when you think of that, you realize that from God's viewpoint, outside and above all of time and history, He's already seen it in His mind in the future and is casting a shadow back into the past. The New Testament is the Old Testament fulfilled, but the Old Testament is the New Testament illustrated in shadows. It goes both ways. So we'll talk about shadows. We'll talk about this term called type and antitype, and that often confuses people. A type is different in some ways than a shadow, because while a shadow was a very indistinct image of something, a type was a very distinct image of something in some way. We use it in our language today. We talk about typewriter. Now, I realize those have just about disappeared in favor of word processors and computers and so forth. But just that very word type, in the word typewriter, you had this, all these little keys, you know, or later it was a little ball or a wheel that had all those different letters of the alphabet and numbers and punctuation marks on it. And when you pressed the right key, the appropriate letter went up and struck the ribbon and through the ribbon the paper. And so what did you get? You get an exact image of what was on the end of that key. And there are many types in the Old Testament. The Scriptures specifically, for example, say that Adam was a type of Christ. We may look at that and say, how's that possible? He doesn't look anything like Christ. I mean, we don't know what he looked like, but I mean, anything about his life at first doesn't seem to be anything like Christ. But Paul said he was a type of Christ. And we have other types of Christ who are referred to that way, whether they use the word type or not. Moses, David, Jeremiah, others of the prophets. More than one of the priests of the Old Testament are pointed to as types of Christ, exact images of Him in some way. We want to look at that. For they were shadows of the good to come. What we see, or what we will see, hopefully more clearly, is as we go through this, we'll start looking in the Old Testament and we'll start seeing signs that pointed to the new. You know, we live in a world in which, as we leave this place and go out in the world, we watch television, we read our newspaper, we look at things on the newsstand, we hear people talking. And everywhere we look, we see people saying, this way to happiness, this way to success, this way to self-fulfillment, this way to better health. And everywhere you look, there's signs pointing all sorts of different directions, all often for the same thing. You know, one sign, in effect, says this way to better health or to lose weight. Let's take that one. That's sensitive for people. You know, so you see this one that says, if you do this, you'll lose weight. But then over here, somebody seemed to be advocating exactly the opposite thing. And so their sign is pointing the other way to lose weight. And all sorts of signs in between pointing in all these different directions. But that's in our world. When we start reading the Scriptures, as we start moving through the Old Testament, we start seeing signs that point in a certain direction. And we keep moving along, we start seeing more and more signs. But the interesting thing is, they're all pointing the same way. They're all pointing the same way. That's what we're going to be looking at. And where are they pointing? They're pointing at Jesus and what He came to do. And because He did come and do it, by inference then, they also point at what we now have. As Peter said there in 1 Peter 1:10 and 11, as the prophet spoke, they were not speaking about things for themselves, but for us.